Blog Talk Radio.
What's up? Peace and blessings to everybody this morning. Welcome to Sankofa Radio, where we travel through the past and we stop in the present on our journey into the future. I am your host, Astari Donso, with my main man, Sundiata Ray Vaughn. And what we're going to do today, man, is we're going to honor the brother, Malcolm X, with a little bit of a talk. And we're hoping that throughout the conversation, we can get some people to call in and add on, man. Let us know your thoughts and opinions as we recognize one of our great ancestors, the beautiful brother. It's customary that we start every show with a dedication, and today is a beautiful day for me because it's my grandfather's birthday. And my grandfather was really a very, very powerful man in the community in Lynchburg, Virginia, where I'm from. He was a bishop. Hotel, son. He was a bishop and an activist in the community. And I learned a lot from him about manhood, family, morals and principles and values. And he was an inspiration to my life and to my family's life. And the way that I am today, in large part, is because of him. And so, the fact that I can even, have respect for the ancestors and my culture and my soul, fully come from this brother, man. I love my grandfather to death. His soul is in me. I am him. I try to live on his legacy. And I want to honor him today, man. I love you. I love you, Grandpa. All right, so moving forward, man, geez, bro, yeah, Malcolm, man, you know how we all feel about Malcolm, you know what I'm saying, especially the one of us who have experience, the old slave system, which, is the prison system. We recognize, the importance of using this space as a place of education to be able to become a valuable asset to the community and to society, and Malcolm is like our greatest example of that. You know what I'm saying? Malcolm came into prison and really reformed himself. I want to give a little background information, man, before I toss it to you, Sundiata, if you don't mind. I want to kind of pick people up. I don't know how many calls we got today listening. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we all on the same page with general information about Malcolm. So I'm going to build a little bit. I ain't going to take long just to kind of get people up to speed. So Malcolm X was born on May 19, 1925. And his father was a Garveyite. He also was a minister. And his mom, she was a Christian, but, and she was a biracial. She was biracial. And Malcolm's experience with his childhood was a little rough. You know what I'm saying? His father was killed early. His mom, when they moved from Omaha, Nebraska to the Midwest, was ultimately placed into a crazy home. And so what that did to Malcolm was that put him in a situation where he lived in a lot of different places. He was in different group homes. He ultimately ended up in the juvenile facilities. He ended up moving to Massachusetts with his sister, ended up in Harlem where he was selling drugs and breaking in houses. Then moving back to Massachusetts where he dated white women and conked his hair out and all that. And Malcolm's life was tumultuous. You know, he didn't have a rosy life. Malcolm had the life that a lot of us have. And he went to prison, and he reformed himself. You know, he began to read books. Started book programs, and I know that, with a lot of people understand the importance, how prisons come to prison can impact a person's consciousness. He once was a street cat, Malcolm came in and started studying, started programs, became member of the Nation of Islam, and then he was released. And upon release, he was seen by people in the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad himself as being a very special brother, charismatic, articulate, intelligent. And was chosen to go city to city from places like Philly and Detroit and New York and D.C. to start mosques and temples. Yeah. And he was able to develop a little local following in a lot of urban areas because of that. And then, you have this period of time in the late 50s where Malcolm is seen on TV in a documentary called The Hate That He Produced, where he gets national notoriety. People are starting to see that, his brother serious, And but he's becoming more of a national figure. And then later on in his life, in the 60s, he begins to kind of question what's going on within the nation after he finds out from Elijah Muhammad himself that he's sleeping with a lot of different girls, And that, he's having he's getting these women pregnant, Malcolm, in his own words, once said that, he looked at Elijah Muhammad like, like God on earth. And so to see this guy, you know, become morally bankrupt, as he said, that was really the only thing holding him there, because he already had been questioning the religious and political ideology of the Nation of Islam. That's Malcolm's voice. So after after this, you know, Malcolm kind of had a split, obviously, and he, you know, he takes another journey, because his first journey to Mecca wasn't after he left. He actually went before the Honorable Elijah Muhammad as an ambassador. We're going to get into all that later, but he ended up going to Mecca, going throughout Africa. He's always credited with Mecca being the, you know, the aha moment for him, if you will, you know, the life-changing event. But actually, it was his journey to Africa, meeting African revolutionaries, that began to really change his political ideology. You know, he had a religious transformation and a political transformation. The religious transformation, yes, happened in Mecca, but the political transformation happened when he went through the continent and visited brothers like Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Touré and Julius Nyerere. And he began to say, well, you know what, man, I'm going to develop a more militant political revolutionary stance and a more pan-African stance. And this is, he goes to the OAU, he gets the idea for the OAAU, comes back, he says, I'm going to organize people all throughout the Western Hemisphere who are black. And he says, I'm going to go back to Africa. So he ends up going back to Africa again. He does this in August. His first trip was in April of 1964. He goes back in August of 1964. And in August of 1964, now he's out there making the case, the African heads of state, to take the case of Americans to the United Nations. You know, his brother was ahead of his time, man. So now, you know, he's becoming an international threat. Now the FBI, who has already been following Malcolm since he left prison, believe it or not, they start following Malcolm in 1952. But they had already been following Malcolm since 52, but he really became a threat at this moment, you know, right months before he was killed, you know what I'm saying? And so obviously we know in February 21st, 1965, Malcolm is assassinated by brothers in the Nation of Islam. But also we have to ask ourselves, what role the FBI played in that? We're going to get into all that, but the question I want to ask you, just giving people some background on Malcolm, just a brief summary. Malcolm, just, you know, what does he mean to you, man, and why is it important that we continue to honor Malcolm year after year, man?
Yeah, it's most definitely a beautiful thing to honor Malcolm X, because I think he's the local street guy's hero. I think he's the voice and the defender, the true voice and defender of the black struggle and also of black manhood. You know, Malcolm, from my understanding, was the first man who intellectually beat the white man down. You know, he didn't use a book. I mean, he didn't use no gun. He didn't use his fist. But he beat them down, and he exposed them to their wicked ways and behaviors of that time, you know, from history and facts and with his mind. And he exhorted the black man and black woman to respect themselves and to stand up for themselves and to speak for themselves. And I think that resonates with a lot of street men, street guys and street women, you know, because we already have that mental toughness in the street. We already have that mentality in the street where, you know, you have to have respect for yourself and let nobody else disrespect you. And Malcolm took it to the man, you know. During that time, people talk trash about, you know, white society for their treatment, but they did it behind their backs. Malcolm was the first one who did it globally and on television, you know, and loved the people. And so I think that resonated with the street guys, because this was a guy who lived that life, who was out there, who was in the mix at one time and totally transformed his whole being through knowledge and education, you know, but who still kept it real and didn't sell out and spoke, was that voice for the voiceless, you know, was that voice for the oppressed. So that's why, you know, we continue to honor him, and why we should, one of the reasons why we should continue to honor him, you know, due to the fact that he wasn't afraid to speak his mind, to stand up and to battle the powers that be, to speak power to truth, you know, and using his own self-will and determination, you know, to change his life and become a righteous man. There have been several times when the FBI tried to entice him after his split with the Nation of Islam to become an informant, you know, where they wanted to give Malcolm money and, you know, certain gifts. And Malcolm told him, look, my hustling days are over, you know, And he was a strong, righteous man, you know, who stood on his principles. You know, and it says body was so clean when he passed away, and they said Google said it, he was like a saint compared to Martin Luther King, peace be upon that brother. You know, so knowing that his character, man, was so powerful, and his drive and ambition was powerful, you know, we got to continue to honor him, and we will continue to honor him. And the truth always going to rise to the top, no matter what the media try to do, the media try to say about this guy, because back then, they was calling him a demagogue, you know what I mean, a hate teacher, a hate monger, well, troublemaker, and, you know, all he did was just told the stories of them. You know, when I say them, I'm talking about the oppressors, you know, and how they was acting to the black men and women and to people abroad all over the world. So that's why I think, you know, it's important that we honor Malcolm. And then one thing also, just, you know, when you were talking about his history while in prison, they added on to his development was he was joining a debate team, you know, and when he joined that debate team, I think this gave him the experience of looking at both sides of an argument and being able to masterfully yield the audience to or play the audience to his perception, you know, and to play with words and play with concepts and use it, you know, to enlighten minds or defeat, you know, all of these naysayers at the time who was trying to condemn, you know, his message. During that particular time, you know, so that's what I think, my brother. Yeah.
Well, I think I'm on the same page. I'm in alignment as somebody who's currently incarcerated and who has transformed himself. Malcolm is the greatest example. I tell people, you know, George Jackson is my man, but there ain't no George Jackson without Malcolm X. Malcolm X, man, is like, you know, he's like the apex for us brothers in here who are actually trying to make that transition. Becoming better black men, more productive members of society, the black society, that is. And I think what was very important about Malcolm more than anything, man, is that brother had a certain determination and discipline to overcome the stigma that society placed on him. You know what I'm saying? That dude went through some stuff, man, and regardless of what he went through, he didn't let that define him. He shaped his own identity. He was diligent and persistent in doing that. And I quit school in the eighth grade. You know, I understand, Malcolm, I was in the juvenile facilities, sold drugs, you know what I'm saying? I did some things that was horrible, you know what I'm saying? I took life, and it's things that, you know, I feel like things that are shameful, but yet they don't define me. I am not my crimes, you know what I'm saying? I am not my mistakes, you know what I'm saying? These are lessons. And so now I'm in the process of redemption. And that's what Malcolm shows us, is that one can be redeemed no matter what, you know what I'm saying, kind of past he has once he makes the decision to transform. And another thing, man, you know, Malcolm educates us, man, his ideology and his analysis, man, particularly later, man, his analysis was so on point, right? You know, man, it's just amazing. It's amazing, man. I want to read a quote, you know what I mean? I want to read a quote, man, that Malcolm said. This is in reference to the people, what we're supposed to be doing. And I want to get your take on the quote. The quote is, the greatest mistake of the movement has been trying to organize sleeping people around a specific goal. You have to wake the people up first, then you'll get action. Wake them up to their exploitation. Okay.
Right.
How you saying that, though? What is Malcolm instructing us with that quote right there, man?
Yeah, because it's still the blind leading the blind, and people just doing something that they have no understanding of what they're doing. So before you can arouse a person to some type of action, you got to let them know why they're in the situation they're in. How did they get in that situation? And those behind the scenes who played a part in creating that condition or situation from the jump. And once you do that, they will naturally want to take the proper steps to change that condition themselves. And so he's seen that, like what we see now, you got a lot of celebrities, artists who's telling people, rock the vote, go down there and hit the polls, do this and do that. But the people still don't have no understanding of why they're going down. They know they don't want this person in office or that person in office, but it still doesn't have that intelligence behind it, that organized spot, you know, from the knowledge about their socioeconomic conditions and all the factors that play a part in that, you know, and Malcolm seen that. Malcolm seen that, you know, wake them up to their situation, wake them up to the powers that be who have an effect in all these policies and bias laws that have been created to keep them oppressed, keep them poor, you know, keep them struggling, keep them off balance. And so that was, that's a great thing. That's a great thing. And to add on, I seen a video clip of Malcolm just to speak on the police brutality thing. You know how clearly and incisive he was. And he was like, he was speaking about how police patrol the neighborhood. He said, how can a neighborhood has the most crime and yet have the most police patrolling it? How can that be? He said, if you have a neighborhood where you got the highest crime rate, but you got the most police patrolling that neighborhood, then what are they there for? They must be monitoring the crime. They must be making sure that you commit that crime. You know, and it speaks the truth. Like, you really sit back and analyze it. Hey, you, in the inner cities, in the black neighborhoods, you have the most police patrolling, observing, and police just watching the beat or parking their cars in these neighborhoods. But this is the areas where there's more crime rate. So how could that be? Right. Their presence alone should, you know, stop it. But it seemed like it's not, you know, and that's the things he made people wonder and spark and seek to know why, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, and, you know, he was making us aware that the police was an occupying force, particularly when it comes to the black community, and not there to protect and serve us because, you know, we don't own no property, you know what I'm saying? Malcolm told us we don't own no property, so they're not there to protect our property, and our lives in America hasn't meant nothing. So they're not there to protect our lives. So what are they there for? They're there to occupy us and to keep us from coming out the hood. You know what I'm saying? They're security force. Okay. They're security force for the dominant culture. You know what I'm saying? Okay. You know, one of my favorite quotes from Malcolm, man, when he said, if a man sticks a dog on a man, that man should kill that four-legged dog and then kill that two-legged dog that sick that dog on him. Now, that sounds kind of crazy to a lot of people. They're like, what? You know what I'm saying? But what Malcolm was emphasizing in there was the right to self-defense. You know, Malcolm never talks about initiating violence. Even though he's oftentimes characterized as a violent person, Malcolm always talked about violence as self-defense. He never talked about initiation of violence. And even in that instance right there, he's talking about, you know, there's no way that you could get a person who has the savage mind state, okay, to stick a dog on a peaceful protester. He's letting you know you can't compromise with him with no love. He ain't trying to hit love. So if I come to this dude, he attacks me, I'm talking love, he attacks me, what makes me think all of a sudden he's just going to start listening to love? But what Malcolm said is, look, man, it don't make no sense. Every species on the planet's first rule of nature is to survive. Yet we got leaders telling us that when we get dogs sicked on us, getting our kids shot, as they did in Selma, Alabama, and he witnessed bombs blowing up in churches, killing our kids, we supposed to turn the other cheek and pray about it. He said that makes no sense. That's not intelligent. That's his words. He said that's not intelligent. And I'm inclined to agree with him. I don't think that's a gazelle tries to negotiate with the lion, my dude. You hear what I'm saying? So we got to start thinking. We got to start thinking about what the brother's saying. I think in today's time, we got to make it applicable in this regard. You got 9 people that got shot in a church down there in South Carolina. Now, I'm not advocating violence. I would never do that. I'm not going to do that. But I'm just saying, you just think about what I'm saying. You got 9 people that were shot down there in North Carolina, and it was programmed in us instantaneously to think we forgive people. You got Trayvon Martin who was killed, you know what I'm saying, by a random pedestrian dude who was a white supremacist. Even though he was Spanish, he was a white supremacist because he was white identified. And just there was no consequence to that. You got police killing day in and day out of unarmed black men, unarmed black women out here in Norfolk. There was a sister recently in March who was killed. Her name is India Beattie, 25-year-old sister, killed by the police. You have all these acts of violence happening. You had a brother who was killed out here in Buckingham County a couple months ago by the police. You know what's going on in Richmond. I've seen a couple killings out there, Portsmouth killings out there. So the police is killing people. Nobody's going to jail. Nobody's going to jail. Now, at what point, you know what I'm saying, do we have to ask ourselves or put ourselves in self-defense mode? When is it going to be legitimate for us to utilize violence? You know what I'm saying? Again, I'm not advocating violence, but what I'm saying is, at what point do we defend ourselves, bro? You know what I mean? And this is what Malcolm brought to the table. He said, look, man, we got to stop looking at love as the only strategy. You know what I'm saying? We got to bring some balance to this. We deserve to live, too. And we love our lives so much that at some point we have to be willing to die to protect our lives. I'm going to say that again. We have to be willing to die to protect our lives. I want to ask you another quote, man. I just wanted to throw that out there.
He was like,
and I
want
to get your thoughts on this.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
To add on, you know, he was like our big brother, you know, when if you ever experienced bullying and you were at the school bus and the guy took on you, a bigger guy took on you, you know, when your brother see it, your brother be like, listen, man, you better hit him back. You know, don't keep letting that boy hit you, you know what I'm saying? Don't give your money to this boy. You know what I'm saying? You fight him back. That's what Malcolm was to the people. And Malcolm didn't have no problem standing up and telling that boy, you know what I'm saying, you a sucker, you know, you picking on somebody smaller than you, you know. And so That's what created that inspiration and also that fear, because he wasn't afraid. He wasn't afraid, no way. And that's what made people look up to him too, you know. Well, like you say, other leaders at the time was talking about love. Malcolm was talking about our natural right as men and women to live, you know, and enjoy life and to experience life and all of its boundaries instead of being beat up, having water holes, forced on us, dogs sick on us, you know, to fight back if we had to, because that wasn't an option. You know, we know they always existed, but he brought it to the table and was like, listen, there's nothing wrong with you having to fight back, you know. Word. No doubt.
Well, I think that for me, man, another quote, man, while you got me, you just sparked the thought, but another quote that I love from Malcolm, one of my favorite, and I'm coming off the top of some of these because I love the brother, man. I got Malcolm. But he says, through skillful manipulation, the enemy has become masterful at turning the criminal into the victim and the victim into the criminal. Now,
that's
you know, that is one of my favorite. You know, Malcolm, you know, what he's saying when he say that, bro, is when you got a thorough understanding of history,
right,
particularly our history in relation to whites. Since we've encountered them, whether you go back to ancient history with the Romans and the Greeks or modern history through the colonial times, it's always been a hostile relationship, one which whites have always tried to enforce power. Okay? Now, you look at the conditions we in today, you just nailed a few things about the fact that the hoods are crime-ridden. Well, what is crime at the end of the day? You know what I'm saying? Crime is just, you know, it's the violation of the law. You know what I'm saying? But whose law are we talking about, and what's the purpose of violating the law? When you're committing robberies, thievery, selling drugs, why do you see this in certain neighborhoods but other neighborhoods you don't? Why would you see somebody who's making $35,000 to $100,000, as me and you talked about earlier, middle class, upper middle class, wealthy person, go rob a store? Why would they have to go into a Safeway and steal some food? Why would they have to go into a JCPenney and steal some school clothes? Boosting.
Right.
Why would they have to hit the ass, hit the pave, and pump that flame, bro? Why they got to do that when they making $35,000 to $100,000? Education-wise, we talked about a couple weeks ago in Richmond City right now, you got schools being shut down. What schools are they? They black schools. So now what's the consequence of that? The consequence of that is people have to – well, you add on for a minute, bro. You add on. I'm going to let you take over.
Yes, sir, brother. Hey, you know, to add on, what you're saying is right and exact. When you have people of a low socioeconomic background, a class who don't have the means to buy the basic necessities of life, nor the employment opportunity, you know, due to their lack of education, lack of vocational training, and being a human being with the basic desire to survive, then they're going to do what they have to do to survive, if that means committing crime. Now, the powers that be know that. They know this, but instead of coming with remedial solutions, they sit back and condemn them. They sit back and watch it happen so they can lock them up in jail and create businesses off of their business, off of their poverty. And that is the biggest crime. And so what Malcolm was saying is, instead of coming with solutions to problems to remedy the poor, you sit back and manipulate and blood suck on the poor. You know, and then you condemn the poor for being poor and doing things that poor people do to survive instead of coming with some type of positive solution. So you commit the biggest crime on humanity by having the means, the money, the wealth to stop it and not stopping it, but allowing it to go on and creating a whole system based on it. So, and that is the biggest crime. And to add on, what we're seeing nowadays. You know, prior to Malcolm going to Mecca, Malcolm was talking about complete separation. Now, I don't totally agree, but one thing about the truth gonna rise to the top. And he was like, listen, if we separate, you know, this will give us time to build our own, to create our own strong infrastructure and to start trusting one another again. Because coming out of 400 years of diaspora in the United States, you know, we have forgotten all of our traditional ways of interacting with one another. So we need to gain that back before we can talk about dealing with another race. We've been dealing with that other race so long that we don't even have knowledge of ourselves or love one another. So he was like, what we need to do is separate and come back and to build with ourselves. And right here, right now, in Richmond, Virginia, historical Jackson War was called Harlem South, you know, before segregation. Well, before desegregation, this was a thriving community, thriving black community with their own banks. Maggie L. Walker, black woman, had her own bank. We had transportation systems, great school systems. You know, we had no choice but to deal with one another, trusting one another. And they say one of the main reasons they caused the gentrification or the breakdown, the collapse of the thriving black community was the desegregation law. And once black people was allowed to move out and move into other neighborhoods, they took the wealth with them. That was one of the reasons. And then they built this big I-95 highway right between the neighborhood, so that they kind of disrupted and messed up the harmony. So I'm like, dang, you know, was Malcolm wrong what he was saying during that time? If you look at now, it had more of an adverse effect, just like he was saying, long, just like he was saying back in the 60s, it's going to have more of an adverse effect. He said all of these bootlicking the other time talk about integration, but it's going to create more harm. You know, he was talking about the fabric of America. He was going back to the Constitution. You was never really written into the Constitution. And another quote he said was that if you put kittens in the oven, that doesn't make a biscuit. You know, he was like, just because right. black men and women in America don't make them American. We don't get the same treatment, you know. And so, and we're seeing it. We're seeing it now. Look at us now, you know, 60, 50 years removed from integration. And really, what have we got? You know, we can go to the same school as a white person, but it seems like now it's even more worse. You know, money don't even stand in the black community. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm going to go ahead, bro. I just want to add on to that because what's oftentimes overlooked about America today is exactly how segregated we are. You know, there's a de facto segregation going on, and it's economic based. So there's not whites only signs no more and colored only signs, but pretty much every space in America is segregated. You know what I mean? Whites live amongst whites, blacks live amongst blacks, Latinos live amongst Latinos, and it's on and on and on and on. You have a few integrated communities. You can go to Facebook right now. Most people's Facebook page, they say Facebook is one of the most segregated places and spaces in America. You know what I mean? You go to Facebook right now, most of your friends black. Most of your friends black, you know what I'm saying? And that's indicative of the schools. Sunday, they say Sunday morning is one of the most segregated times of America, black churches, white churches. You know, so we live in this fairy tale of post-racial society, right? But at the end of the day, the economics is making us segregated. So we segregated, you know what I'm saying? And the problem is we segregated, we still relegated to low-income and poverty neighborhoods while the white live in middle-class and wealthy neighborhoods. Now, what you're talking about, this white flight is as it's coined, right? This happened a lot in the 50s and 60s with the development of urban housing projects. And in urban areas, what happened is they start bringing blacks down into the inner city, and whites started moving out to the suburbs because they didn't want to integrate. You know what I'm saying? That was their response. So this is how blacks started getting concentrated through the migrations into the inner cities and whites out in the suburbs. Well, what you have today, you have a concept called gentrification and urban renewal. What they're trying to do now is renovate these spaces, bring whites back into the urban areas, and kick the blacks out. And what they're doing is they're trying to get closer to the commercial districts because whites not feeling the fact that they happen to commute an hour to get to work or that all of the commerce and economic activity is downtown, but they live out in the suburbs. So they're trying to take our black ass back out to kick us out in the suburbs, and they're trying to come back and get that space back that they ran from 40, 50 years ago. You know what I'm saying? And so dealing with the segregation aspect, the first thing we got to understand that Brother Malcolm knew, that's why what you say is so powerful, bro, is that they don't really want to integrate with us. us trying to integrate with them has been a fight. Some people ain't never wanted to integrate with us, man. And I don't want to castigate every white person, because I know that every white person doesn't think the same. But what I'm talking about is a collective consciousness that exists amongst whites that we must accept. White people as a whole do feel entitled to a certain amount of power, whether or not they are conscious of it or unconscious of it. It's a concept they call white privilege. Okay, now let me show you how that works. Let me show you how that works, bro.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Right now, you've got a heroin epidemic that's affecting white people. You've been having this heroin epidemic affect black people since the 1960s, right? And during the Vietnam War, in response to it, the black revolution, regardless of what they tell you, in response to the black revolution, you had youngsters 24, 25 years old start movements, Huey P. Newton, Stokely Carmichael. They said, we got to slow these niggas down, the FBI. We got to slow these niggas down. They trying to start a war. Heroin all of a sudden pops up in the community in vast amounts. You got people like Frank Lucas supposedly bringing drugs in through military planes, bro, and the FBI and the CIA don't know this. Okay, so now what you have is a drug epidemic that begins to sweep the black communities for 30, 40 years. Crack comes in. Nothing's going on but mass incarceration of blacks. Okay? Now white, because of the opium, Oxycontin, craze, pharmaceutical companies getting these whiteys drugged up, excuse my language, getting white people drugged up, getting them addicted. Now they're using heroin, they're addicted to heroin. There's a problem with dope. So now, as I see in the prison, they got all these programs. Bruh, do you know in the last 2 years they done stopped putting dudes in segregation for drug use because they know that the drug use in the prison now, particularly the heroin, is affecting the young white? They had a bill they put on the table in the last session in the General Assembly that would have made a person giving somebody heroin and they die of an overdose, that would have made the person who was responsible for giving that heroin up guilty of second-degree murder. Now, all of a sudden, they want to criminalize, you know, giving people bad dope as heinous as giving them a murder conviction. And all of this is an example of how whites feel entitled and privileged to protect themselves, because white lives matter, right? So Malcolm understood the consciousness of the white man. And when I say white man, I'm not talking about skin color. I'm talking about a person who identifies as white overall human being, right? He understood that, because if you say I'm white, then what you're saying is I'm privileged. Right, because white was created specifically by colonists when they was going into different lands, enslaving people and killing people to distinguish themselves from the indigenous people. So they come to America and they say, well, we got to figure out how we can make ourselves different when we create these laws. So, okay, I'm white, he's a nigger, and he's a savage Indian. Okay, and that's the difference, you know what I'm saying? And so white was not about the skin color per se. It was about an identity, you know what I'm saying? Are we all human beings, or are we white, black, Native American? You dig what I'm saying? That's deep, and that's what Malcolm understood. As long as we identify as white and African American and Native American or whatever, then there's always going to be a distinguishment between who we are, and then that's going to cause competition, and the white man has power. So a white man is going to be on top. You know what I'm saying? And as long as the white man is on top, he's going to feel entitled to be able to have certain things, certain privileges. And they feel like, yo, just like look at Barack Obama. They want their country back. People got to catch the language. You know what I'm saying?
That's
the
language
shows you
the
white privilege that exists in the collective consciousness of the people out there, man. When they say that the NRA supporters say that we got our guns because we trying to protect ourselves from the thugs and the terrorists. Who's the thug and who's the terrorist? From the illegal immigrants. Who's the illegal immigrant? They're not saying, they tell you subconsciously what they talking to. The black man is the thug. The Muslim man is the terrorist. And the Spanish man is the immigrant. And a lot of people listening today thought the same thing when I said it. That's how they mind F you. You know what I'm saying? Because they associate you with certain words. But I'm going to add on to that, man. Malcolm understood that we need separation and empower ourselves.
That's right. He also understood the trickery in politics. And he said that what you have is a case of the fox and the wolf. And he said that the fox is like the Democrat or the Democratic Party. And the fox, he's not going to outright tell you that he's going to devour you. You know, he said he's going to give you very clever words. He going to print this picture like he there to help you, but he's sly, he's clever, so he's going to devour you slowly, you know, without you even really recognizing until you already been consumed. He said, well, the wolf, there's no sugarcoating it with the wolf. You pretty much know what the wolf going to do. He got his teeth growling at the mouth, saliva coming out of his mouth. You know, you see the fangs, you see his canine.
Donald Trump.
So you know
Donald
he's going
Trump.
Right. Donald Trump all day long. You know? But, and so everybody know, you know, from his language, his political party, you know, the whole attitude. You can feel the white tension and hatred and dissatisfaction all in his campaign and in his language, you know. And so Malcolm was educating people not to be deceived by the Democrat, though, you know, because they might come with nice words, but really, you know, look at what they've done. Lyndon B. Johnson,
Bill
for example, Bill Clinton, you know, even Kennedy, you know, he attacked, you know, because he was like, hey, okay, if you really about democracy, I mean, Malcolm, man, was so ahead of his time. And,
yes,
and
he was.
He really can't, because he even knew about democracy, you know, like, is this really a democracy? You know, a democracy is every man has the majority rule. So if we even say the majority rule, we can see the flawed concept of that when you're dealing with a racist nation. Okay, if this is democracy and the majority rule, so now if the majority of the people are white and they have this mentality, like you said, white privilege, you know, then that means the majority of people are going to be motivating and moving off of this type of attitude. So the whole concept of democracy is going to be flawed there. You know, if the majority of the people feel like white people should come first, black people need to sit at the back of the bus, back of the line, go drink water around the corner. So now we're going up against a whole force. That's not true democracy, you know. And so he was trying to educate people on these words that we use, you know, and these ideas and these concepts that we're supposed to abide by and showing that it's not adding up to reality, you know. And so we even seen that today, you know what I'm saying, with Donald Trump talking about he going to build a wall. He not only talking about some border to separate the United States from Mexico, he talking about a financial wall, you know, where the rich going to get richer, the poor going to get poor. You know, he going to build that wall. He talking about building that wall. He going to block it off. You know, it's going to be a demarcation. It's going to be a line put in the sand. And either you go, you have or you going to have not. And so that was the great thing about Malcolm. He was able to see clearly through all the lies, like with Hillary Clinton, and you know how these politicians, they say one thing to do another. When you start to look at their history and see what they voted on and what did they advocated, what did they rally behind, it totally contradicts what they say they stand for. You know, so that was one of the smooth things about Malcolm. He was able to, you know, expose people. He brought forth historical facts on why they were saying it just was a bunch of words, you know, a bunch of rhetoric. They had no substance at the end.
Malcolm understood clearly that the enemy uses what we call coded language. And he would decode, as you say, bro. You know what I'm saying?
Sure
he knew that racism, he knew that the enemy was wise enough not to come up there and say, F the niggas, we just gonna, you know, neglect the niggas. But he knew they would say, you know, they would come up with a phrase called benign neglect. You know what I'm saying? Or or they wouldn't say, you know, after blacks, we're going to lock them up. We know that we need to, you know, we need to get some more control of our country. They would say, you know, I'm appealing to the silent majority. You know what I'm saying? Or they would say, like Hillary Clinton said back in 94 when they was creating this system of mass incarceration, in the inner cities we have super predators. You know what I mean? Or you have Bill Clinton talk about the super predators in the hood who get young boys hopped up on crack and get them to go out and kill other blacks. You know, just to see how disconnected our so-called first black president is. I know damn well when I was out there, I wasn't selling no crack to no 13-year-old. You know what I'm saying? But this is what he promoted to build mass incarceration, right? So, yes, they are masters, welfare queens. You know, we know who Ronald Reagan was talking about with the welfare queen. You know what I mean?
Right.
They are masters at using code language, just like when they say stuff like, you know, the jungles of Africa versus they'll say, you know, the wooded area when you start talking about your places in Europe. You'll never hear about no jungles over it. But what, you know, jungle represents, jungle is associated with savagery, right? So it's always
savagery,
coded
right.
language, man. It's coded language, man. You know what I'm saying?
So
and you have to be able. Right. The people are not, we're talking about people who control the world. Let's stop minimizing their level of intellect. You know what I'm saying? These people know exactly what they're doing. And like you said, they know how to mine after you, man. You know, so now you say, well, Hillary's not bad. She's, you know, she's for us. You know what I'm saying? It just tripped me out, bro, to see this was a bugged out stat I seen the other day, man. I seen where 70% of African-American women, the largest demographic of women in the country, support Hillary Clinton, more than white women. Only 49% of white women support Hillary Clinton. 70-some percent of black women support Hillary Clinton, bro. And to me, right. that was amazing, knowing what her husband, the policies her husband created with welfare reform. Do they know, do sisters know that now if you live in the hood and your husband or your boyfriend come out of prison, he can't come over there because they'll take your welfare? Or if you got, you know, if you live in an apartment complex, you're on Section 8 or whatever, and they tell you, you know, right. if anybody come over here, you know, we're going to take it, or if somebody stand in your house. And this might be the father of your child. You know, all that started with this dude,
right.
man. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
This dude made it to where you couldn't get certain welfare benefits unless you worked, and you can only get them for a certain amount of time. He didn't care how many kids you got or how much education you didn't have. He didn't care nothing about that. He came and stripped all that. You know what I'm saying? And
that's
Hillary
right.
supported him with that, man. This woman
that's
is
right.
wild. These people are wild. But
right.
I want to ask you, man, moving forward, man, Malcolm, I want to read another quote right on Malcolm, man. I want to get your thought on this. He says, you know, we have to make the world see that the problem that we're confronted with is a problem for humanity. It's not a Negro problem. It's not an American problem. You and I have to make it a world problem. Make the world aware that there'll be no peace on this earth as long as our human rights are being violated in America.
Right.
How you see that, man? What is he talking about?
Yeah, man, that's powerful. I think he's, at this point, he's beyond the American rhetoric and running around like a dog chasing his tail trying to seek some type of justice from a system in America. Now he sees it as, you know, we're all human beings and it's beyond race, even though race is the ultimate underlying theme of one race trying to have some type of control over another race. But that's a sickness in itself, you know, because biologically we're all human beings. You know, we all have 46 chromosomes mostly, you know, express ourselves under all the human characteristics. So we are humans, but he's saying that, you know, it's beyond that. Like, the world needs to see the problems that exist when one race feel like they have the right to oppress and exploit another race, you know, and the potential threat, you know what I'm saying? Because the human potential is so great, you know, the levels that we can achieve through mind elevation, you know, through science and through study and through coming together and sharing information can be so powerful and so great for this world, the planet Earth. But when you allow a group of people, any group of people who feel like they can just exploit and oppress and suppress the greatness of another race, you know what I'm saying? It's so wrong. It's so wretched. And I think so he, at this point, he's beyond just trying to seek retribution or justice in America because he knows it's all biased. So now he's ready to take it to the international level, take it to the United Nations, where he really wants to see, shine a light on a problem, you know, because trying to solve it within the justice system, there was no avail, there was no help. So now he's exposing, you know, America and all of their policies to the world, showing that, hey, this is beyond a civil rights issue. This is a human rights violation. You know, you are systematically oppressing and destroying and contaminating and corrupting a group of people just out of greed. For no other reason but just to have power, you know, greed, more and more greed than you can even use in one lifetime. And so that's when he became the threat. That's when he became the target, you know. And I think his trip abroad opened his eyes to that, you know, seeing other countries fighting for their independence, seeing other countries gain their independence, and seeing how other countries started working together, you know, to help other countries remove that illness from their societies. And so he was like, okay, that's what we need to do. We need to take it to the United Nations. And at that point, you know, that's when the dogs, they stick the dogs on Malcolm. You know, he became a threat. They didn't want their dirty laundry to be aired. You know, they didn't want their filthy ways to be exposed. And so it is my opinion, you know, that's when they started to create a counter operation to, you know, to silence Malcolm.
Yeah. Okay. I think we got a person who want to ask a question. Okay. Do we got a guest that's trying to add on with the conversation? Please do if you're there, man.
Yes, I want to ask a question.
All right, how you doing? What's your name?
Hello?
Hello?
Hello, how you doing? What's your name?
My name is Anissa.
All right, what's up, Anissa? What you got?
Okay, I'm wondering if you could bring us up to date with your idea or your opinion about how Malcolm would have responded to an Obama administration. Now we've got a man who identifies as African American, who is supposedly the most powerful man in the world. I'm wondering how Malcolm would have responded to that in respect to Obama being president of the United States, but also in respect to what you think he has accomplished or has not accomplished as president of the United States. What would Malcolm, what do you think Malcolm's take would have been on all of that?
Right. So I'm going to touch that quickly, Mr. Russo. I'll let you add on. I ain't going to take too long on that. First of all, Malcolm became a Pan-Africanist. He went to Africa and began to understand that our best chance of true liberation was to identify with the continent and the people of the continent. He didn't necessarily believe we needed to go back, but he believed that we needed to culturally identify with the continent and see that we had one aim, one God, one destiny, as Garvey would say. Obama just is the first president to openly bomb an African country, Libya. No other president has ever done that. You know what I'm saying? Obama's history, he's from Kenya, yet he bombed Libya. And Muammar Gaddafi was trying to resurrect the OAU. He was a staunch Pan-Africanist. He identified as a Pan-Africanist, and he really was big on trying to develop sub-Saharan Africa. So his death was detrimental to the Pan-African movement, to the black liberation movement globally. He loved black people so much, he even identified Condoleezza Rice as his flower in the White House. So, you know, he didn't discriminate on your political ideology when it came to your blackness. I'm talking about Gaddafi now. Obama killed him.
Right.
So I look at Obama as sort of like, as I told my queen one time, your uncle who put you through college but molested you. You know what I'm saying? It's like the brother, you know, we're proud of the brother because he's a face for us of black manhood that's not one of criminality, that's not one of, you know, ignorance, even though we know we possess more than that. But those are typically the images. Obama's defying that. But there's a lot that he could have done that I feel like he didn't. He was silent on a lot of things. His stance on the police killings wasn't strong enough for me. What's going on in, as far as economic development in the community, it's not strong enough for me. His foreign policy towards the continent, I ain't feeling it. I feel like he spent too much time in the Middle East and not on the continent. You know what I'm saying? And I think that him being a black man in America, yeah, the criminal justice thing, you know I'm not feeling that. I feel like he's taking a soft stance on that. Some of the things he's trying to do is just – it's just fill-ins. It don't even really. It's not going to even do anything to end mass incarceration. So I'm mixed. I'm ambivalent. Symbol-wise, he was great. Substance-wise, you know, I don't know. What you think, Truson?
Yeah, to add on, I think you know your assessment is pretty much on point. However, I think it's hard to answer questions like from the perspective of a person who's not here, you know, to answer that question and see things for themselves. Because his understanding stopped at that time in 1965. So, you know, understanding always evolves. Your understanding always expands as you live and you learn and you see more things. You know, so I can't speak on how he would see things today. However, what we do know of Malcolm at that time, we do know that Malcolm paid very close attention to details. And he seen through smoke screens and seen through lies and deceptions like they had the March on Washington. But while a lot of people thought that was a great accomplishment for black people, during that same time, Malcolm X called it the farce on Washington. And he's seen all the mechanics went behind the Jewish powers and elite, how they went about and constructed this whole thing, and how they actually quieted the real fire behind the March on Washington. Because initially, that March on Washington was supposed to be like this radical protest where people was just going to shut down Washington, D.C. They wanted to demand jobs. But once the Jews got involved and convinced Martin Luther King and all the other civil rights leaders, you know, to accept their money, then they kind of like pacified and made it weak, you know, and it really didn't get nothing accomplished except for just that symbol that we marched on Washington. So I think Malcolm, you know, he would see through a lot of these policies and he would question, you know, he would question. He was an outspoken man. And he would have been very vocal about certain policies Barack passed or things Barack did, like the brother say, going into Libya and having this man executed. You know, this guy who wanted to create this monetary system that will overnight, you know, uplift Africa, man, unifying Africa, you know, which is a great thing. So I think he would have questioned him. He would have questioned him. He would have got us. He would have opened our eyes to a lot of political agendas or laws being passed behind the scenes that we didn't know nothing about because he was a great investigator. So, you know, I think he would have at most, you know, challenged Barack, challenged him to do more for us as a people.
Mm-hmm.
Word. That's
can
a
I
great
ask
question.
A follow-up question?
Yes, sure can.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yeah, EDP. Sorry. Hello?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. I had my phone on mute by accident. Yes, sir. Yeah, please do for me. We want to hear from you.
So you want to ask a follow-up question?
Oh,
Anissa,
yes.
Yeah, please ask.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to talk about AFRICOM. Because there are people who believe that the whole purpose of Barack Obama's election as president of the United States was to facilitate United States foreign policy towards Africa through its AFRICOM program. So I'm thinking back now about what you were saying about Malcolm being a Pan-Africanist, and then Obama, the idea that Obama was promoted into power kind of to counter that and to insert the United States into Africa for a completely different kind of, you know, an agenda. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, sure. The American power structure is always looking for places to exploit. I feel like that's the nature of the beast, you know what I'm saying? And so, obviously, they have an economic interest in Africa. The question is, man, and this is what Brother Malcolm was asserting, and I certain those of us who consider ourselves to be freedom fighters for black people, does it benefit Africa? You know what I'm saying? And I think, like you say, you know, Malcolm can be looked at as neo-colonial, in my opinion. I mean, I'm going to be frank. You know what I'm saying? To me, man, I'm still grappling with, you know, is Malcolm neo-colonial? I mean, excuse me, not Malcolm, I'm sorry, Obama neo-colonial.
Yes, Obama.
I feel like, I feel like Obama, you know, he allows for some of the more revolutionary African leaders to feel more relaxed, like the brother Uhuru Kenya, you know, when he comes with the AFRICOM mission and he's trying to do all these dope African development deals, you know what I'm saying? I feel like, man, at the end of the day, he's an agent for the economic interests of the power elites over here in America, you know what I'm saying? And I feel like, you know, they have always, you know what I'm saying, going back to Christopher Newport, been anti- us, you know what I'm saying, been about exploiting us, exploiting our labor. So, yeah, I mean, I'm real critical of Obama, to be honest with you. I'm not a big Obama fan. I think, again, symbol-wise, sure, peace to the brother. But if you really understand, if you have an analysis like Brother Malcolm had, you really understand the position black people are in globally, you know what I'm saying, and you got a position of power like that, especially in your last year of office, I'm expecting you to be bold and do some bold things, and I just ain't seeing it, man. You know, I'm not really impressed.
Right.
Yeah, you want to add on to that, True?
Yeah, that's my sentiments too. You know, I feel like for an educated man who has a background in Africa, you know, you want to do your best to try to see that country remain, you know, safe and secure from, you know, imperialism, from economic exploitation. And, you know, prior to Barack Obama getting into office, this brother used to be in Chicago street. You know, so he went to school and studied law. So he know all about sociology and factors at play dealing with capitalism and exploitation and the pearl. He know these things. So, you know, to have a more passive role and to know about foreign policy and, you know, international monetary fund and how there's an imbalance of trade when it comes to the United States and these other countries and their natural resources, you know, I feel like when the moment of truth came for him to make a decision, he didn't make a decision in favor of Africans. He made it in favor of, you know, the elite bankers, the elite class, you know. And so basically, he sold out in that point, you know, because if you look at the state now, that's what they did. They went out there and killed Gaddafi. Now this country, man, is Libya is all the pieces now. You know, the harmony they had. And the wealth that they had is all collapsing. You know, little civil wars going on out there, and everywhere the United States go, that's what they create. They create this imbalance. So, and he could have prevented it, and he didn't. So, feel like you was down with it. Hello?
Yes, thank you.
that's my take. Yeah. Peace. Great question.
Thank you.
Sorry. Yeah. So so just traveling and getting there. You have any more questions?
Can you hear me, man?
Yeah. Now we can.
I'm sorry, man. I keep accidentally hitting this mute button. Thank you for the questions, Anissa. It was very informed questions. It was great questions.
Thank you.
We got we got 3 minutes left. I want to do some promotional stuff before we run out of time. First, I want to say support Prison Lives Matter. Go to Facebook. We have the website up soon. Go to Facebook, Prison Lives Matter. We about to start this thing nationwide. You can check for me at Askari Danso. That's Askari Danso. That's two different words on Facebook. Listen to old shows. Communicate with me there. Go to RIHD.org. That's RIHD.org. Support Ms. K. Help the brothers. Mass incarceration is real in Virginia. The prison industrial complex is real. She's banging. She's been an activist, fighting for over 15 years, and she's making a lot of progress, but she needs more support. Call her. She's open on Tuesday all day to talk, but you can always call anytime, and she's willing to talk. And support the brothers behind the wall, man. Free all political prisoners. There's a lot of guys in here, man, who thinking how to be an impact in the community, trying to develop themselves, better themselves. We need more support from the community. Mass incarceration. We can't be continue to look at ourselves as being two different communities. We have prison system, and we have the black community really as being one. And so we need support from the people, and the people need our support. You know what I'm saying? I think I lost my man, True Son. Hopefully he can come back in, but if not, support him at Operation Wake Up. Also, go to his Facebook page at True Son on Facebook to learn more information about that. The brother, I met him behind the wall, and he's got out, hit the ground rolling. The brother's doing amazing things. He's dead serious. We all are. And support the brother out there. You know what I'm saying? See how you can help him out. In closing, man, I just want to say to everybody who's listening, Malcolm X, man, is deserving of intense study, respect, honor. The dominant culture, when you're not conscious, you know, there's a lot of promotion of the dominant culture's history daily through television shows, advertisements, and we just subtly just accept these suggestions as being the truth, perspectives of history, points of view of history as being true. Malcolm gave us an alternate perspective. He told us not to see George Washington as the first president, but as a racist baby killer, slave owner. He told us not to see Thomas Jefferson as this great author of the Declaration of Independence, but to see him more as a slave breeder, somebody who was anti-liberating human beings and one who helped orchestrate genocide. You know what I'm saying? He constantly got us to look at things from an interest and from a standpoint that was in our interest. You know what I'm saying? As African people who was forcibly removed and brought over here to America, which is the greatest crime. And this is why he said, you know, they turned the criminal into the victim and the victim into the criminal, because he realized that we all were just acting out of a condition. You know what I'm saying? He was trying to educate us to that. And this brother, man, was, you know, a brother who quit school, a brother who was in juvenile facilities. Once again, I reiterate, a foster home, drug dealer. He went to prison and reformed himself. He's my inspiration. And so we need to constantly look, check for Malcolm, study Malcolm, and the people who learned under Malcolm, like Huey P. Newton, Stokely Carmichael, and various brothers like that who gave a lot of credit, George Jackson, who gave a lot of credit to Malcolm. You know, Malcolm was the first person to really have a certain boisterous that exists throughout all the black community now. Malcolm was sort of like the first, I say, battle rapper. You know what I'm saying? Malcolm was calling dudes out like battle rappers do now back then. You know what I'm saying? We're down to a minute. So once again, man, thanks for everybody for listening. Remember, man, Sankofa Radio, the first step forward is going back to the past. We love all y'all. Black people stay strong. Black power in 2016. Free all political prisoners. Yahoo Root.